The Timing of Jesus' Death, the fifth talk in a series titled, Is the Bible Trustworthy? Responding to Bart Ehrman, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 17, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The notes mentioned in this talk are in handout number 4 in this series.
Okay, I have one more week that I'm scheduled to teach here, and I wanted to add one more week onto the series that I began last fall on Is the Bible Trustworthy? I'm looking at going through bit by bit, problem by problem, contradiction by contradiction, through the book Jesus Interrupted by Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman is a professor in New Testament who is a very prolific writer and sells a lot of books, basically debunking the Bible from the perspective that hopefully you and I share about the Bible, that it's a authoritative work, yea, even an inerrant work. And he has spent his last several years trying to debunk that notion by pointing out all the contradictions and problems and tensions and whatnot that you have in the Bible. So I want to, one by one, problem by problem, contradiction by contradiction, sort of look at those so-called contradictions and problems and take a look and see if he's right. I finished the major part of chapter 1 in his book. I want to enter into chapter 2 now. We may eventually go back and look at the other problems that he mentions in chapter 1. They're less important and less convincing, so I want to go to some of the more important ones. So we'll be looking at the first one that he raises in chapter 2 that he calls a world of contradictions, and that's his title for the chapter, referring to the New Testament primarily, well, to the Bible in general, and he focuses on the New Testament. But before I do that, I want to just kind of remember why it is that we're interested in this. Why are we doing this? Let me turn to it and read it. Here's how John starts his first letter in 1 John. What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, and the life was proclaimed, and we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus, the Messiah. Neither you nor I are all that interested in going back 2,000 years and making sure that we know exactly what happened, when it happened. If Jesus died on one day rather than another day, that's not all that significant to us. It's the fact that he died and the meaning of his death and the significance of his death, obviously, that's what's important. We don't really care what day he died on. So the problem is not that we are kind of perfectionistic sticklers for details who can't sleep at night until we have all the details right. That's not what's at stake. What's at stake is the message of the Bible, what John called the word of life, the logos of Zoes, the account of eternal life, that's of vital importance to us. Because it's going to make the difference between whether I die, whether I live this sorrowful, tragic life that we're in and die and am gone, or whether there's hope beyond this life for us, and that we are going to go on living forever in the eternal kingdom of God, where there will no longer be evil, and there will no longer be death, and there will no longer be the disappointment and futility that characterizes our current human existence. Does that hope belong to me, or does it not? Well, one thing that becomes through loud and clear in the Bible is what makes the difference between the people who are going to go on and live and those people who are going to be destroyed is whether or not we have, from the depths of our being, from the depths of our insides, have embraced as true the message of eternal life that John introduces his letter by saying, that's what we proclaim to you, so that you might share an understanding of that in common with us and with the Father and with the Son, that you will know what we know. That's what he means by fellowship. That you will know what we know and believe what we believe. And in doing that, we mark ourselves, we characterize ourselves as people who are not going to be destroyed, my existence is going to go on forever. Well, that's not nothing. That's hugely significant. The problem is, as John will go on later in his letter to talk about, is we're in a fight. There's pitch battle going on. There's warfare going on. The lies that come at us don't stop. And we are barraged over and over again, day in and day out, by all kinds of other messages, other voices, other so-called truths, other stories that come at us, that if we don't have what it takes, they are going to sweep us away, seduce us away from the truth. Either seduce us actively into some lie or put us to sleep so we don't care about anything. The apostles recognize, John in that letter is going to go on to describe it as a victory when we come to belief and hang on and persist in our belief. It's a victory. There's a war going on, and we win the war. He puts it, we overcome the world if we maintain the faith. Well, one of the major artillery that's firing at us in this war that's going on is the kind of stuff that Bart Ehrman is doing in this book. It's been around for decades. I first confronted it when I went away to college and I was an undergraduate taking classes in Old Testament and New Testament and Western civilization and all that kind of stuff. Coming from a Bible-believing, conservative, sort of fundamentalistic background, I had heard none of that stuff. And it was day after day after day after day of the message being sent to you, you stupid idiot. I mean, what kind of stupid hillbilly idiot would believe the Bible's actually true, that it's actually historically accurate and so on? We sophisticated academics and intellectuals, we know better than that because we know stuff. And the stuff that we know makes it incredible that you would actually take this stuff seriously. And that message is a constant in our culture. If you go to the Discovery Channel, that's the message. If you go to the History Channel, that's the message. If you go to ABC, it's worse than that. I don't care where you turn. Every museum you go to, everywhere you turn, the intellectual, established, sophisticated, acceptable culture is telling you that if you actually take the Bible seriously as history, you are a nut. You're an absolute ignorant fool. It's hard in the face of constantly being faced into that message. It's hard to read the Bible and let it just be the word of life to us, because you can easily just turn around and dismiss it as, it's a great idea, nice fairy tale, it would be nice if it were true, but I can't count on it. I can't place my hope in it. I'm not going to drive any stakes in the ground on this one. That's why we're taking the time, because if we can't answer the kinds of charges that someone like Ehrman makes here, then it really does raise the question, do we believe this stuff with intellectual integrity? Are we being silly and foolish and gullible and naive and ridiculous to believe this stuff? Or is this sound, sober history, and we'd be a fool not to take it seriously, at least consider it, because there's something that really happened, and I have to decide what that means for my life. That's my position. It really happened. The people who are writing about this stuff really knew what they were talking about. They weren't making junk up. They were telling us the truth as they experienced it, as they saw it, as they understood it, and have recorded that for us. And we then need to read that, take it seriously, and confront the question, what am I going to do with it, and what am I going to do about it? So that's why we're doing this. Question?
I don't know if it's significant, but he's really regurgitating stuff that's been around for a couple of centuries.
Oh, yeah, I meant decades of my life. But the stuff that is the basis for his criticism have been around since the mid-1800s, for sure, at least. Yeah.
Advisors to the kings, many of them would use kind of God-laced advice that was counter to what God wanted, even back then.
Right.
And it's just interesting that you alluded to this, that the most dangerous ones are the ones that I say that are really wolves in sheep's clothing, but they think they're in sheep's clothing.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Okay, that's why we're going to look at it. What is it we're going to look at? Let's look at the contradiction that Ehrman thinks he sees here between the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John. And the critical issue is the timing of Jesus' death. On what day did Jesus die? And in introducing this, Ehrman introduces this as an example of an absolutely irreconcilable contradiction. This is an example for him of one that is just irrefutable. This just is a contradiction, and there's no way it's not a contradiction. So he's putting a lot of weight on this particular example. Okay, I think what I need to do here to show you, there are a lot of issues, and it's a little hard to juggle these details and these technical issues. I'll do the best I can here. And I think the best way to do it would be to talk our way through the Gospel of Mark as Ehrman interprets it. And remember, as we go through here the first time, this is how Ehrman is interpreting what Mark is saying. Then we'll go through John, according to how Ehrman is interpreting John. And then I want to look at all the assumptions that Ehrman is making that leads him to interpret each of them the way he does. And I'm going to reject every one of his assumptions. And then we'll finish by putting the account together in such a way that John and Mark are actually quite reconcilable. As Ehrman reads Mark, Mark's account begins on what would be Wednesday evening, Thursday, the day of Thursday. Remember throughout here, and this is what makes it so tough, this drives me crazy because I can't keep it straight, but the day in Judaism starts at sundown and then ends the next sundown. That's their day, sundown to sundown. So when I talk about a day, I have to say Wednesday, Thursday, because it starts Wednesday sundown and goes all the way to Thursday sundown. So I'll hyphenate Wednesday, Thursday, and that's what I mean. So it starts on Wednesday, Thursday, actually probably the afternoon, late morning or afternoon of Thursday, when some disciples come to Jesus and say, "Where are we going to eat the Passover meal? And what should we do about that?" And Jesus gives them instruction, tells them where to go, how to find the room that he has prepared ahead of time for their Passover meal, what part of the city it is in, and who to make arrangements with. So Mark 14:12 says, "On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed, his disciples said to him, 'Where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?'" So several things of note there. One, this is not an issue for anybody, I think, but it is odd that he calls it the first day of unleavened bread, because any way you cut it, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is the day after Passover, not the day of Passover. So why is he calling the day before Passover the first day of unleavened bread? I have to assume it's sort of like talking about Christmas Eve as being the first day of Christmas. It's not technically Christmas, but as we celebrate the Christmas season, oftentimes there are many Christmas Eve festivities. So you could easily see someone saying, "Well, on the first day of Christmas, we did this." And I don't mean the carol, but I mean, and referring to Christmas Eve. I think that's what's going on here, is because the day before Passover was a day of preparing for the Passover meal. As he puts it here, it was when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed or offered. Passover, as you know, centers around a particular animal, a lamb, that you take to the temple and offer it up. Then you take the carcass of that animal, you take it to your home, and you have a meal centered around that meat of the lamb. And the instructions are pretty explicit. You are to eat the lamb, and don't let any of the lamb be left over in the morning. You must consume the whole lamb. And there's all kinds of very particular details about the lamb that is supposed to be eaten at this meal. Well, that begins the day before Passover. The day before Passover is when you offer the lamb in the temple, and you make all your other preparations, and you prepare the meal. And you actually eat the meal on Passover, but remember when Passover starts? After sundown. So the first thing you do on the day of Passover is eat this meal, where you eat the lamb and the other trimmings that go with it. That's the Passover meal, and it happens, according to this theory, then it would be Wednesday evening, sometime between sundown and midnight is when you're eating this meal. So the disciples, sometime Wednesday during the morning or afternoon, say, where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover? And then as the Mark account goes on, he gives them instructions, and they go and do it, and they find the room, and they prepare the meal. So sunset comes. Jesus and the disciples gather in what we know of as the upper room, where they had this meal. They gather there, and they actually eat. They then eat the Passover meal together, Jesus and his disciples. It's quite clearly presented as a Passover meal, and in fact, in the Mark account, as in several other gospel accounts, is where he takes the cup and passes it, but he says, this is the blood of the new covenant, some version of that. This is my body, eat of it. That he reinterprets the midrash of the meal. Jesus gives a brand new, what they call midrash, a brand new interpretation of the symbols of the Passover meal. An interpretation of those that involve him, Jesus. And this would be the first time in the 20 to 30 years that his disciples have been keeping Passover that anyone has given this interpretation to the symbols of the Seder, the Passover meal. The point that Ehrman is making is this is very clearly a Passover meal in Mark. So then sometime later that night, they leave the upper room, which is on one side of the city, traverse the city, leave the city, pass over the ravine of the river Kidron to the Mount of Olives and a garden there called the Garden of Gethsemane. And the Garden of Gethsemane has been Jesus' hideout. He's been spending every night over there hiding out from the authorities so that they don't take him by night to kill him. That, of course, is Judas' betrayal, is Judas knows the hideout. So on this particular evening, Judas leads the temple guard to the hideout in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives. He leads them there. They arrest Jesus, and they take him back into the city to the home of the high priest to be tried there. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but this is in the wee hours of the morning on Thursday morning that this trial is taking place. Then early in the morning, how early we don't exactly know, but I think we're talking anywhere from maybe as early as 6 o'clock to somewhere around 8 o'clock, he's taken to Pilate's palace. Actually, it's to the praetorium where Pilate is staying. He's taken there and tried by Pilate. Pilate offers to release Jesus to a crowd that's gathered there, but they refuse Jesus. They prefer Barabbas, the rebel, instead. They want Jesus to be crucified. So to appease the crowd, Pilate hands Jesus over to be scourged and then crucified to keep them happy. After being scourged then, Jesus is taken to a place called Golgotha, and that very same day, and he's crucified there. Now, Mark in 15:25 says it was the third hour when they crucified him. Now, part of the problem is going to be what mode of time telling is Mark using? Assuming he's using the Roman method of telling time, sunrise, roughly 6-ish, would be the beginning of the day. The third hour would be between 8 and 9 a.m. Friday morning. So Mark locates it in the third hour, 8 to 9 a.m. Friday morning. Now between 11 a.m. and noon, darkness came over the whole land while Jesus was hanging on the cross. It lasted about 3 hours till somewhere between 2 and 3 p.m. Because Mark says, when the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. So that's roughly from between 11 and noon until between 2 and 3. Notice that in all the time telling, in all of the gospel accounts, it's always the something or other hour. So it's an hour time span. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But you don't get anything like our time telling at 3:14 or at 7:18. We're not pinpointing a certain time after an hour has been reached. We're talking about anywhere from the second hour is 2 hours to 3 hours after sunrise. Then Jesus died at the end of that darkness at about the ninth hour. So Mark says, at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. So somewhere between 2 and 3 p.m. on Friday is when Jesus died. Then Mark makes it clear that Jesus needs to be buried quickly. So Jesus is quickly buried before the Sabbath day begins sundown. At sundown around 6 p.m., the Sabbath is going to begin. They have to get him buried before the Sabbath begins, so they have to hurry. Mark puts it in Mark 15, 42, 43, when evening had already come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, and he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate and ask for the body of Jesus. So then he gets buried before sundown. At sundown, we have the beginning of the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I neglected to tell you that. The Passover is combined with, if you go back to Exodus, they are to celebrate the Passover celebration, and then the next day after the Passover celebration begins another festival called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It lasts for 7 days. So the Passover and then 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The first of those days is supposed to be a Sabbath, and the last of those 7 days is supposed to be a Sabbath. So Passover, Sabbath, 5 days, another Sabbath is the pattern as it's prescribed in the law. Now, I can't speak to the issue of were they keeping it exactly like that in the time of Jesus. I can't speak to that, but if they were to obey the Mosaic Covenant, that's what they would have to do. Keep a Sabbath the day after Passover and then again 7 days later. And those Sabbaths have nothing to do with the weekly Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath is an entirely different thing. So potentially, during this time, you could have three Sabbaths. You could have Passover, a Sabbath, a couple of days, the weekly Sabbath, and then finally the Sabbath at the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So within a roughly 9-day period, you could have three Sabbath days during that time. That's one thing that I will talk about. Ehrman neglects that and I think creates a lot of confusion. The only other thing I need to say about the Mark account is going back to Mark 14:12, the first box on your chart, on the first day of Unleavened Bread when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed, his disciples said to him, where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover? Now, Ehrman interprets preparing to eat the Passover as suggesting that the day before Passover is a day of preparation, right? It must be a day of preparation because you have to prepare to eat the Passover meal. The disciples ask him, where do you want us to prepare to eat the Passover meal? This must be occurring on the day of preparation. So the day of preparation happens, and then the next day, which would be Passover, Jesus gets killed, gets crucified. Okay, that's Mark's account. Now let's go back and look at John's account through Ehrman's eyes. In John, nothing happens on the Wednesday-Thursday time. We begin on Thursday, in the Thursday-Friday time, sunset begins what John calls the day of preparation. Because he calls it the day of preparation, and he does so several times, Ehrman assumes that day of preparation is the day when you prepare for the Passover meal. All right? So this Thursday-Friday is not Passover. This Thursday-Friday is the day before Passover in John's account. I hope you're following me. We're still keeping it on Thursday-Friday, but whereas in Mark, it's actually the day of Passover, in John, it's the day before Passover, what he calls the day of preparation, where you prepare the Passover meal. So we jump into the middle of that in John, where Jesus is eating a meal with his disciples. But, Ehrman points out, John does not clearly present it as a Passover meal, which would stand to reason because we're not on the day of Passover, according to Ehrman. So, of course, they're not eating the Passover meal. This is the day before Passover. This is just some sort of more ordinary meal than that. It's true that he doesn't call it a Passover meal in John, and it's true that you don't have anything in John that would suggest the bread and the cup, the significant elements of the Passover that Jesus interprets. John doesn't mention those in his account. So putting those together, Ehrman concludes, this is not the day of Passover, and this is not a Passover meal that we're talking about. But they eat this meal, and then the story goes pretty much like it does in Mark. Later that night, they go over to the Garden of Gethsemane. There in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's arrested. He's taken to the high priest, where he's tried by the high priest and the Sanhedrin. And then early in the morning, again, it's early in the morning of the day of preparation, Jesus is taken to be tried by Pilate. So in John 18:28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Ehrman doesn't mention this, but I think this is the most convincing thing in the whole John account in favor of Ehrman's interpretation, but he doesn't mention it. But I think he just assumes that we're on track with him and he doesn't need to mention it. But it does say they're concerned about going in to be with a Gentile, Pilate, because they don't want to become unclean and be defiled because they want to eat the Passover. Well, if Passover happened the night before, why are they worried about being defiled before they eat the Passover? That's a problem that we're going to have to look at, we have to solve. So that would seem to suggest that Ehrman is on the right track. Yeah, John sees the meal the night before as not a Passover meal, and they're in the day of preparation now, the day when the lambs are being offered, and early in the morning of the day of preparation, they don't want to get themselves unclean, defiled, to wreck their Passover celebration on the next, after sundown. Pilate offers to the crowd to release Jesus. The crowd refuses Jesus, accepts Barabbas instead, and they want Jesus to be crucified. Then, according to John, just before noon, and that would be 11 a.m., between 11 a.m. and noon, on that same day, the day of preparation for the Passover, Pilate pronounces that Jesus is to be taken and crucified. Okay, you begin to see the discrepancy. In Mark, Jesus was crucified between 8 and 9 in the morning. In John, between 11 and 12, Pilate is just now getting around to giving orders to go crucify him. So for John, it's between 11 and 12 on the day of preparation, the day before Passover. And for Mark, it's between 8 and 9 in the morning on the day of Passover itself. So there's the discrepancy in the time. John 19:13 through 16 says, therefore, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. So they cried out, away with him, crucify him. So that he then handed him over to them to be crucified. Okay, so far so good. Sounds like Ehrman's on the right track. So Jesus was taken to Golgotha and crucified there. A lot of different things happened as he was hanging on the cross. Remember, crucifixion is designed to be a slow, excruciating death. They are to hang there. Sometimes people would be crucified for days, depending on the circumstances. So it was not intended to be quickly dispatching a person. You were torturing him to death over a period of time. So Jesus died then, and in John 19:30, therefore when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished, and he bowed his head, and he gave up his spirit. The soldiers, seeking to hasten Jesus' death and the others that were being crucified with him, come around to break his legs. because they must remove him from the cross before sundown, because the next day is going to be the Sabbath, and Aaron is thinking that that's the weekly Sabbath, so they need to get him off the cross before the weekly Sabbath. In John 19:31, then the Jews, because it was the day of preparation, so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So Jesus is quickly buried before the Sabbath day begins at sundown. John 19:42, therefore, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So here's the contradiction. I'm hoping that that was clear enough. The time of Jesus' crucifixion in John is around noon on the day before Passover. According to Mark, it's on Passover day itself, about 8 to 9 in the morning. And then the other contradiction is that for John, the Last Supper is not a Passover meal. For Mark, it is a Passover meal. Okay, so that's the problem that we need to solve. What are Ehrman's assumptions that have gone into his interpretation of both Mark and John? The first one is he assumes that Jesus died on a Friday, just as tradition suggests. And it is amazing to me how persistent that belief is. I think it's because of the power of tradition in our midst, that even scholars who I really think ought to know better, keep insisting that Jesus died on Friday. But as we saw with the resurrection accounts and Peter's denials and the other things that we're looking at, all kinds of problems are solved if we will just acknowledge that there are other Sabbath days besides the weekly Sabbath, and mostly the Sabbath being mentioned in the gospel accounts in the last week of Jesus is not the weekly Sabbath. Only once is it the weekly Sabbath. Every other mention of the Sabbath is the Sabbath that is the day after Passover, whenever Passover is. So if Passover is on a Tuesday, then there's a Sabbath on the Wednesday. If it's on a Thursday, then there's a Sabbath on a Friday. So wherever Passover is located, the next day is going to be the Sabbath day of the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Well, Ehrman isn't even thinking in those terms. He automatically is trying to place all these events such that Jesus dies on Friday. Second assumption is that the day of preparation, and the Greek word that's translated the day of preparation is paraskeuē. That the paraskeuē that's mentioned in John 19:14 is the same day that is mentioned in Mark 14:12. Now, what am I talking about there? Remember, we started with Mark 14:12. On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And because they're preparing the Passover meal, Ehrman just automatically makes the assumption, well, that's a day of preparation. The problem is, the day before Passover, I found no evidence whatsoever that that is ever called a paraskeuē, that that word, day of preparation, is ever used to describe that day. And it only stands to reason that you wouldn't use the word paraskeuē for that day, because paraskeuē means the day when you make all the preparations that you have to make because you can't work on the next day. Well, the day before Passover is not a paraskeuē because the Passover is not a Sabbath. It's a holy day, and holy days happen on that day, but not every holy day is a Sabbath day, and the Passover is not a Sabbath day. It's the day after Passover that's a Sabbath day. But Passover is a day when you can work. Well, you don't need a paraskeuē the day before a day when you can work. You following me? The word paraskeuē seems to mean a day that requires you to make preparation so that you don't have to work on the next day. The day when you're offering the Passover lamb doesn't qualify as that kind of day. If you spilled over and were still carving the Passover lamb on Passover, you'd be just fine. You don't have to have it all finished by sundown because it's not a Sabbath. I found no evidence that the word is ever used that way. And in fact, in Mark 14:12, he doesn't even use the corresponding verb to paraskeuē. There's a verb, paraskeuazō, that he could have used in Mark 14:12 when he says, "Where do you want us to go and paraskeuazō to eat the Passover?" But he doesn't use that verb. He uses hetoimazō instead. It's an entirely different concept, an entirely different word. And it sure looks to me like, at least in the New Testament literature, paraskeuē and paraskeuazō are completely reserved for the preparation you make for a Sabbath on the next day. Remember, on the Sabbath, you don't eat on the Sabbath if you haven't already prepared your meal the day ahead of time. Because to actually prepare a meal on the Sabbath would be considered breaking the Sabbath. That's why you need a paraskeuē. But you don't need that for Passover, because it's not a Sabbath day. So it's a very quick and specious assumption that Ehrman is making when he says, well, they had to prepare the Passover meal, so it must have been the day of preparation. No, not so. So notice instead what we have is, according to Exodus, Passover is when you eat the Passover meal. The next day is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is a holy Sabbath unto the Lord. That makes Passover a paraskeuē. You following me? So Passover is not only Passover, but it's also the day of preparation for the next Sabbath day. So when John comes along and keeps talking about the day of preparation he's talking about is Passover itself. Do you see the fallacy in Ehrman's logic? Because John is calling it the day of preparation, and the day of preparation must be the day that you prepare the Passover meal, and the preparation of the Passover meal is the day before Passover, then John is saying that Jesus was killed, crucified the day before Passover, not on Passover. But when you recognize that the day of preparation and Passover are the same day, then when John says that he was crucified on the day of preparation, he's acknowledging that he was crucified on Passover, because it's the same day. Third assumption. Ehrman says that John does not mention Jesus' disciples preparing for the Passover meal, and he doesn't mention the reinterpretation of the elements of the Passover, and he assumes that that's because, in John's view, John is not portraying that meal as a Passover meal. That's why he doesn't talk about preparing the Passover meal, and that's why you don't see any of the elements of the Passover meal mentioned in John. My contention would be, when we go back and look at the Gospel of John carefully, one thing that's very striking is there is very, very, very little overlap between John and the other Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. John almost always is talking about an event or a teaching or an aspect of an event that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, don't even mention. That's not absolutely true, but it is striking how little they overlap. Now, why is that? I think there's two things going on in the Gospel of John. One is, John is writing later, and so he's intentionally, purposely trying to fill in things that haven't already made it into the written tradition. So John seems to automatically assume that his readers can go to the other Gospels or other such sources to have certain details filled in. So, for example, the fact that it's a Passover meal, why does John not bother to tell us that? Well, because, like, we all know that. I mean, haven't you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke? I mean, this meal that we're talking about was the evening before he died on Passover. This was a Passover meal. He doesn't need to tell us that because it's already clearly fixed in the tradition that he's making a contribution to. And I would argue that's very self-conscious on John's part. He's not intending to duplicate the information that is already out there. He's intending to fill in, and this is the second point. The other thing that's striking is how much of what John gives us is eyewitness stuff. Not perhaps completely and entirely, but this is John telling his story. from his own memory, from his own experience, from his own encounter with Jesus, he's read the accounts that are there in the tradition, and he said, I have some things that I can contribute that I remember happening. I remember how this went down. I need to record that to fill out the picture for people. So, again, I think it's a specious assumption on Ehrman's part that because John does not explicitly identify it as a Passover meal, and because he doesn't explicitly tell us about the reinterpretation of the Passover, that John doesn't believe it or doesn't know of it or is thinking differently about it. I just don't think that's a valid assumption, particularly in view of the way John writes and the purpose for his writing. There are, in fact, indications that John does mean, that are internal to the gospel, that he does mean us to understand that it's a Passover meal. None of John's details with regard to the Last Supper rule out its being a Passover meal. And there are other indications that I think that it is a Passover meal. So, for example, in 1914, 1931, and 1942, the evidence clearly suggests that John is situating Jesus' death on the day before a Sabbath, right? Well, the day before Passover, would not be a day before a Sabbath. So if he's locating it where Ehrman says he's locating it, on the day before Passover, then how is that a day before the Sabbath? Now, Ehrman's answer to that is, but it's the weekly Sabbath. Passover is corresponding with the weekly Sabbath. So that would work if, in fact, it's valid to locate his death on Friday, but for all kinds of reasons, I would argue that that doesn't work. You end up with all kinds of endless contradictions when you try to make him die on Friday. And then, I can't prove anything by this, but it's interesting, isn't it, that John is the one who talks about the custom of releasing a prisoner for Passover? Well, it stands to reason, it's plausible at least, that happens on Passover Day, if he's being released for Passover rather than for unleavened bread. If it's for Passover, there's only one day of Passover, so it would seem that the custom is for Pilate to release a prisoner on Passover Day. Well, clearly John is locating that, the releasing of Barabbas and the crucifixion of Jesus, on the day when Pilate offered Jesus freedom, which would be Passover Day, not the day before Passover. So they are subtle, but there are some indications even within John itself that John expects that we know that this is all going down on Passover. Okay, the fourth assumption that Ehrman makes is that implicitly, I think, he never mentions it, but to give him the benefit of the doubt, I think he would mention this, that John intends to portray the trial of Jesus as occurring the day before Passover, when he depicts the chief priest as not wanting to go into Pilate's residence and thereby make themselves unclean before they eat the Passover. As I said, that would be the most compelling piece of evidence in favor of Ehrman if it holds up. The problem is our translation, because the word for Passover meal and the word for the Passover lamb are the same word. You would describe them with the same, with pascha in Greek. Pascha is the meal in which you eat the lamb, but it's also denotes the lamb itself that is eaten at the meal. If you go back to Exodus, and I reminded you of this earlier, part of the requirement of the Passover meal is that you consume the whole lamb before morning. It was considered a violation of the celebration if you had any leftover lamb left behind. You had to consume it all. So when they are complaining to Pilate, well, we can't come in because we don't want to be defiled because we need to eat the pascha, that could be referring not to the meal, but to the lamb itself. And remember, it's been a busy night, even for the Sanhedrin. They were awakened in the wee hours of the morning, taken to the high priest's house. They've been gone from their residence, gone from their home, from somewhere roughly after midnight until the time when they're coming to Pilate, which could be as early as 6 o'clock. Their concern could be, we didn't finish the meal, the Passover meal. We've got to get back and eat that before it's too late, and we can't be unclean when we do that. So we can't, like, talk to you, Pilate. We can't go into your house. You need to come out to us. And it seems to me highly likely that that's what they're talking about. When you translate it Passover meal, then it clearly makes it sound like they have not yet eaten the Passover meal, and that would be a contradiction. But there's nothing about that word that requires that that's what it means. Okay, what about the 9 in the morning, between 8 and 9 in the morning, and roughly between 11 and 12, roughly noon? What do we do with that? Well, I think we're dealing with two different time-telling systems. Mark, it seems reasonable to me, is using the Roman system. So his 8 to 9 slot, the third hour of the Roman day, that makes sense for when Jesus is crucified. The question is, what's John's time-telling system? I have proposed a time-telling system where from sundown to sundown the next day, there are 10 hours. Now let me back up. The Greek word hora, we translate it hour, but it really should be translated something more like watch. So when it says that he was crucified in the third hour, that's in the third watch. That the day in Roman time is divided into 12 watches from sundown to sunrise. The night is, and then the day is divided into 12 watches from sunrise to sundown. And we have inherited that as a 24-hour day. We have made our hours a precise amount of passage of time. That was not true in the ancient world. Notice that your hours got longer or shorter depending upon whether it was winter or summer, because you're literally going from sundown to sunrise in the night and dividing it into roughly 12 equal parts, 12 equal watches. Well, those watches were called, a watch was a hora. Well, what if you had a different system where the day was divided into different watches, not the 12-night, 12-day Roman system, but what if you took sundown to sundown and divided it into 10 watches? Then each watch, each hour, if you will, is 2 hours and 24 minutes long. What's interesting is when you go to the Gospel of John, and every time John talks about something happening in the whatever hour, third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, whatever, that it's plausible. That system is plausible. A system of 10 watches in a 24-hour day. 10 watches in a revolution of the rotation of the earth. If that's the case, then the sixth hour then ends up being from 8 to a little past 9:30, which is exactly the same time frame that Mark says that he was crucified in. So I think that's what's going on. The only problem with that theory is I don't know anyone else who's ever seen any evidence that anyone used that time-telling system. So that's what I need to wait on, is for somebody to unearth the evidence that somebody did use that system. Who else might have a watch system? The temple. Priests came from all over Israel and came into Jerusalem, and they had various duties that they performed, and they had various times at which they were to perform those duties. It would only stand to reason that they divided the day into times of service when the priests and Levites had to do their particular functions, that they had to be on duty. So is it conceivable that the temple had a different system and that John is using that system? I think that's very conceivable. Mm-hmm.
Jack, in the Middle Ages, until clocks were available, they had a system very much like that.
That was actually a 10-watch thing?
Well, not that, but it was adjusted to season and so on, and was measured from morning to night.
Yeah.
And it was adjusted during the year.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, I'm almost out of time. There's just one other assumption. Ehrman makes the assumption that John is either ignorant or he's playing fast and loose with his facts. And why is he playing fast and loose with his facts? Because he's inventing an interpretation of Jesus' death. And he's wanting to propagate that and advance the notion that Jesus was like the lamb being offered on the Passover. was like a Passover lamb who was being sacrificed. So he tries to make Jesus' death simultaneous with the offering of the Passover lamb, and that's why he did it. That's the most insidious assumption, because the perspective that the apostles and the New Testament writers are actually inventing Christianity, I mean, their perspective is, who knows what happened? They're just these kind of random events happened about Jesus, this dude Jesus who got himself crucified by the Romans, and rumors started about him being raised from the dead, and all kinds of weird stuff happened. But the so-called disciples came along later and had to give unity and organization and an interpretation to all of that. So the meaning of Jesus' death and resurrection, his life, his teaching, and all that kind of stuff was not invented by Jesus. It was invented by the disciples later, and they came and they imposed their theology on this history. And they really didn't care all that much about the history. Didn't really matter to them what really happened. What really matters is that we understand Jesus in a particular way, and I'm going to tell the story in a way that's compatible with the message that I want to send. Well, that is an assumption of modern biblical scholarship, not a conclusion. And it's critical to see that. Why has Ehrman made what I think are mistakes in his assessing the evidence here? Because he's already made up his mind before he starts assessing the evidence. I mean, every good Bible scholar knows that whatever else is true, this is not an accurate account. We know that's the case. So when he sees something that looks like it's a contradiction, he's so ready to go there. He's so ready to just decide, well, yeah, that must be, here's what's going on there. And what's interesting to him is, what was John's theology? What was Mark's theology? What were they trying to propagate as a understanding of Jesus and his death and his resurrection? That's what's interesting to him. Well, that's what's interesting to me too, but it's interesting to me for different reasons. Because I think what we're getting from Mark and John is the actual objective meaning of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. We're getting what's really true, what is really significant about it, what is really meaningful about it, and what its real implications are. Because they're telling us not only the event that really did happen, but also what Jesus himself had set them up to understand as the real and actual significance of what went down. And sure, that's the stuff that's important to us, is the meaning and significance of all this. But if they can't get the history right, why would I trust them on the meaning and significance part? I'm going to be trusting the same people for both. He died for your sins. Is he just making that up? Or did Jesus really teach that? Did Jesus really tell him that that's what he was going to be crucified for, because he was dying for our sins? Well, if you don't even know what time of day he died, and you can't get that right, and you can't get that straight, I'm supposed to trust you that the colossal, eternal significance of Jesus' death was he was dying for the sins of the world? Which is easier to believe? So these are more connected than Bible scholars are inclined to make them. Ehrman keeps insisting in this book, oh, you can still go on believing. You know, you can still have your faith. You can have your faith and eat it too. You can still believe it. You just don't think it's grounded in anything that actually happened the way that they said it happened. Just don't be thinking that. No. If it didn't happen, we're fools to place our hope in Jesus' death on the cross. We're fools if it didn't happen with the significance and the meaning that Jesus claimed for it. And how am I going to know the significance and the meaning that Jesus claimed for it? Because he set his disciples up to understand that. He taught them. He told them. He said what he said. I'm going to Jerusalem to die for the sins of the world. Well, if he didn't really say that, then why are we believing this stuff? Okay, that went way too long. Let me give you 5 minutes and then I'll let you go.
What's the highest hour referred to in the New Testament?
9, I think.
So that leaves a whole lot of either
Yeah.
open. I mean, it, how does that affect your view of the time notations? I mean, how do we know they ever counted beyond nine?
From the New Testament evidence, to my knowledge, I mean, early in John, he talks about how two disciples followed Jesus. Right? They went to ask Jesus where he was staying, and it said it was the ninth hour, and so they stayed the night with Jesus. That's significant in my mind, because if that ninth hour has to be getting near sundown.
Right.
The Sabbath is an annual celebration.
Passover.
So, Passover. Yeah. And so is it a different day of the week each year?
Yes.
It is? What determines it?
I think it's always on the 15th of the month, Nisan, because it's the fixed day of the month that changes the day of the week.
Okay. So when Passover's over, then we're in the Sabbath,
right,
even if it's in the middle of the week.
Right, exactly.
And then if that happens on a Wednesday, then coming up on Saturday, we have another Sabbath?
That's right, exactly.
Okay.
So if you'll notice, if you got the handout, my interpretation is that on Monday, Tuesday is when the disciples came and prepared the Passover meal. Tuesday, Wednesday is Passover. When they ate the meal on Tuesday night, Jesus was crucified the next morning. Wednesday, Thursday was a Sabbath day because it was the first day of unleavened bread. Thursday, Friday was now the day of preparation for the next Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, the day after on Saturday. Saturday was the Sabbath, and then Sunday he was raised from the dead. And as I pointed out last fall, this has the virtue of Jesus being 3 days and three nights in the grave.
Okay.
If that's the scenario, if that's logic, which is what he said he was going to do.
So when Jesus was crucified, they had to hurry up before the weekly Sabbath.
Yeah,
is that
no. Before the Sabbath that was the first day of unleavened bread. Because he was crucified on Passover.
Right.
The very next day is a Sabbath. So the next day is the Sabbath, the holy Sabbath, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread.
Okay.
And they had to get him in the tomb before that happened. And John points out, I read by it quickly, he said, and that was a high day. See, I think they must make a distinction between a weekly Sabbath and a, what I will call a high Sabbath. Weekly Sabbaths are relatively mundane. They happen once a week. But the Sabbath that is the Sabbath of the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that's a particularly holy day. It's a Sabbath day that you must keep holy because it's an annual festival that you must keep holy. So it's sort of doubly holy in that sense. And I think that's what John means when he says parenthetically, this one was a high day. And I would argue that that's evidence that it's not the weekly Sabbath he's worried about. It's the Sabbath that is a high day. No one mentions that. They don't do anything with that. But it's there in the text. I mean, you got to do something with it.
Just a detail again. If Jesus was crucified on Wednesday, Sabbath was Thursday, then Friday was day of preparation, but they could work on that day. It's just the women came on Sunday with the spices because they couldn't do it on the Sabbath. So they could have done it on Friday.
They could have, yeah. That's a great question. Why didn't they do it on Friday? My guess is they couldn't fit it all in the day. They're having to prepare for Sabbath the next day and get, and Luke is the only one who tells us that the women on the day before the Sabbath went and bought the spices to prepare him for burial. My guess is the shopping for the Sabbath the next day as well as the burial was more than they could fit in and then go embalm the body on that day as well. So they got everything ready on the day of preparation for both Sabbath and the burial. Then they had to rest a day, and so Sunday was the first opportunity that they had, I think. Anything else? Okay, I fear that probably was hard to digest orally, so I would encourage you to download the notes and take a look at those and kind of think about them, and I think you'll be able to reconstruct what I was saying from that if you couldn't follow my rambling oral presentation. So thank you.